Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman. Sitting in for Cindy Wolf today is Lindsay Willie, the Chief Sommelier for Foreman Wolf. And we have as a guest Patrick Harney in the studio, a wine broker.
Good to be here, Tony and Lindsay.
And we've been doing a little bit of discussion, but I want to kind of speed up the discussion into a little bit of a quiz for you guys. So, or maybe we should put Lindsay in charge of the quiz.
I like
so,
that.
So, yeah, there we go. Now we have with the lady running things, we're going to be much more efficient.
Much
Do we
more
have
organized.
A buzzer here?
Exactly. So, if you would run down your list of wines that no one cares about, and we're going to try to give you a why it failed, you know, or why it doesn't go over, and why it should, and how to use it, because is that we're all sitting here talking about the things that we care about that we think are special that can be used a certain way. That people walk into a retail store or look at a wine list and don't ever grab. And oftentimes, the things we're talking about are the things that are a lot of the best purchases in the marketplace, especially when they're used correctly. Okay, you're
okay.
In charge.
Are you both ready? So Viognier, to start.
The name.
But it's the name. It's a French word. Viognier is. It's. I mean that the name is one thing. I mean, but Cabernet Sauvignon is a French word, or
True.
Two French words. Chardonnay is a French word. I think if people liked the wine more often, the name would not be as bothersome, you know.
I think there's a lot of bad examples of Viognier out there. It's walking that tightrope between the floral qualities and the cloying qualities and somehow getting a wine with acidity and going back to what we were talking about earlier, finding a Viognier that comes from the right place is key.
Allow me to translate for Patrick. The wines often tasted like soap, especially when they're planted in places in California in the 1990s. I think it's one of those things that the New World wine industry thought, wait, this is the next big thing. This is all this amazing flavor. People are going to love it. It's going to go great, especially on the West Coast, with all the Pan-Asian food, because it does, when it's from good places. And they planted it in a bunch of bad places, and it tastes like, sort of like cross between soap
yeah.
and...
talcum powder.
You know, like yeah. like your great-aunt's soap.
Yes.
With a dollop of honey or something.
Yeah. When it tastes good, what should it taste like, Lindsay?
Well, the floral quality is definitely important, but it needs to have that acidity to balance and kind of, I like to sort of think of the fruit as almost kind of crystallized, I like crystallized ginger. You know, it has like an intensity that includes the floral note, but it isn't cloying, and it's got to have the structure and the lift to balance that.
It's an intensity of fruit and acidity, but the acidity is important, but I think it's less important. That's a wine that's built more with, it's pretty alcoholic, and it's a little bit inherently bitter from being alcoholic, and I think some of the structure of the, if the material is good material and it's grown in the right place, there's a density to it that creates almost like a little, you know, it's sort of oily and crunchy at the same time. And I recall having, with you, Patrick, Viognier from Condrieu in France, at a restaurant in New York with sushi.
Absolutely.
That was just spectacular with, was it Yellowtail with with jalapeno, with a Condrieu that was just one of the best, like one of my top 10 all-time favorite combinations because of the soy and the salt and the spice and that sort of exotic fruit oil cocktail sort of thing that the Viognier was very, you know, voluptuous in the mouth. And anyway, that's probably the last time I should say that.
Well, that can go out of hand very quickly with Viognier, and it needs to be disciplined.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
But a great foil nonetheless for Indian food, curries, things like that, just perfect.
Yeah. Did we talk about white wines from Bordeaux?
You tried to.
Okay.
But I kind of stopped you. So, so what's your point, Lindsay?
So my point is there are some, I think, outstanding examples of dry and sweet wine. And oftentimes, I think they're overshadowed by, I mean, amazing reds that come from that region. But what do you think about those wines?
You usually see two things. You usually see inexpensive whites made mostly from Sauvignon Blanc that are fruity, easy, and 90% of the time not good quality. But boy, they're sure $12.99,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And once in a while, you find a very worthwhile one there. So I think they've competed against themselves a little bit. There's an awful lot of bottlings of just like straight Bordeaux Blanc or Entre Deux Mers that are not notable. The ones that are pretty remarkable are usually from the villages of Pessac, Léognan, and that area around Graves, where there are really not that many great places to grow whites, Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon together. And usually the wines that are even blended, the two more or less, they get this like rich, nutty, firm character that will age 5, 7, 10, even 15 or 20 years. And become really beautiful as time goes along, especially for a rich fish or for cheese. And but it's not, you know, we're, like we were talking about sherry, but having it in a quiet moment. These are not bowl you over wines the first sip without food. These are wines that are really, you know, for an entertainment, you know, like a lunch from 100 years ago, and you have to use them that way.
Absolutely. I think Pop Clément Blanc is one of the single best white Bordeaux out there. It's just a remarkable wine.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, we were just trying an 05 Carbonneau yesterday, and we had it with asparagus, and it just, it changed so much. The wine was so much more alive than when you were just sipping it on its own. So it's not something you're just going to casually have on your front porch. You need to give it a job to do.
Yeah, asparagus is tough. Asparagus and like a rich fish at the same time, especially tough. And it's that balance, a little bit like Suave can have when it's good. It's the pretty darn fruity, but the structure is pretty bitter. It's not so much the acid. There's a certain bitterness to the acidity. It's the texture of the acidity that makes it work. That bitterness is what actually takes on the strong elements of flavor. And the wine shows really, really fruity in that application.
Yeah, it was fun.
I think there's a whole bunch of wines that nobody cares about that pair particularly well with asparagus. Arnaise is one of them. And I think you touched upon an interesting point because, again, you have this bitterness, this hardness to these.
Arnaise is a front porch wine for me.
Absolutely.
I think I'm a little more bitter than the average wine drinker.
But asparagus is a tough oil, especially this is the time of year for it. But Arnaise, Graves, actually this little Albana here, another weird wine that happens to do real well with it.
Because everyone drinks Albana. I think you're more likely to have someone confuse that as the name for a professional wrestler than you would
Lou Albana.
Thinking of artful creations from the 70s,
right?
As opposed to some kind of an interesting white wine. And again, that's the big fruity, bitter kind of kind of character. And I'm using that word fruity, which is terrible, right, Lenz?
Well, you didn't say sweet, so you're okay.
It's because it's not. The drinking public, what I want you to know, wine is made from fruit. If it doesn't taste like fruit somehow, it's bad wine.
Right.
It's an agricultural product. You know, I think that white Bordeaux also suffers from some of the timeliness we talked about with Merlot. When I was in culinary school, one of the revelation wines I had was Carbonneau. I mean, that wine was, and back in the 80s, I'm dating myself now, but that was a fairly popular category that had fallen out of favor as wines from all over the world, especially whites, became more and more popular.
So what's else on your list, Lawrence?
All right, so from northeast Italy and Friuli, the reds from that region, which can...
Yeah, those are definitely Rodney Dangerfield wines.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing like Refosco.
No, and sometimes Refosco. That's a good thing, though. That's another one of those things, like the native varietals. One of the reasons those guys planted a lot of Bordeaux varietals, Merlot and Cab, is because the native varietals were pretty poorly made for a long time, and they got a bad reputation, so they would... They tried planting other stuff to restart their industry. And while, you have to be able to survive as a business if you're making wine, it's not just one of the arts. It's the most complicated of the arts.
Absolutely.
And so I think if they didn't spend 10, 20 years, trying to sell Cabernet and Merlot, they never would have had a shot to go back to the native varietals and have them appreciated.
Yeah.
So like Refosco or...
Pignolo.
Pignolo. Yeah. Pignolo and Scopatino are definitely... important wines to me and probably no one else. The tiny little berries, super, super dense, super tannic, really earthy. They have always, when they're good, they have a certain like loamy character that is particularly nice with some, especially game. That's the thing, is you go to Friuli, you want to eat the game, you want to eat the goat, you want to eat the little lamb or the wild ducks, and those are strong things, and you want red wine with strong flavors.
Yeah, then like nice buckwheat polentas and, strong cheese and all those things you need. Moschioni's wines are just really unlike anybody else's
in
that region.
That's another tier. That's a whole other tier of quality and intensity.
You know, just to touch on growing native varieties, because you and I watched this guy going back to Apulia with Roberto.
Yeah, yeah.
Watching him struggle year after year with coaxing the innate beauty of Troia. And we tasted a vertical of his wines, and you can see him every year just managing to figure it out a little bit every year, because you only get one time a year to sort of tweak your method.
Your laboratory takes a long time to get a data sample.
Yeah, But he's making remarkable wines now, and I think when we visited him,
he was still blending it with Malbec. He was still trying to do all kinds of things to try to make it commercially viable.
Yeah.
But Uva di Troia, like most Southern Italian native grapes, they're all 2,000 and 3,000 years. They're probably pretty adapted to the place if you figure out how to grow them.
Yeah, and he figured it out, and then he just manages to get all those little subtleties in it to make it a remarkable and much more difficult to make than you know Primitivo or some of the other more popular varieties.
Well, I think it's also going to be a little more age worthy too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's a good estate name to know, Santa Lucia.
Yeah.
So what else is on your list, Linz?
So sort of it's staying in the red category, but from northwestern Spain, so varietals like Mencia.
So how were you introduced to Mencia?
Mencia. I think it was a small producer that, who's the guy from North Carolina?
Andre Tamers.
Andre Tamers had
he was a pretty good missionary for a lot of
Chacolí, Mencia, all these weird wines from Spain, and he had one and it reminded me a lot. It was in that same family of wines, fruity wines with interesting qualities like Dolcetto, like Cru Beaujolais. It's that same fresh, vibrant, you know.
Some of the problem with Andre's wines over the years, because he obviously had something in mind, and he would import not just one but maybe seven of them.
Right.
Yeah. And the one might be really interesting, but he's got another six he's got to figure out how to get across.
Right.
That are not quite the same quality level. I think that the biggest thing with Mencia and the most important appellation there are a couple of appellations that are good for growing that grape, but the Bierzo.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
I can't help but say it correctly and. It's Bierzo.
Bierzo for the rest of us. Right.
And
but that's an incredible region. It looks like Germany. You know, incredibly steep vineyards. You know, slaty soils and just crazy.
But yeah, and there are a lot of people that would say, "Oh no, that grape is actually Cabernet Franc." And no, it's not. It's another grape out of the Middle East that you know has been there for 1,800 years or something like that.
And how do you use that? What's the best example of a pairing for that?
I'd love it with like strong grilled fish, shellfish, lobster on a grill is fantastic with that.
You need that little bit of smoky
exactly.
kind of note
the soil has that. It's going to come through it. It's going to come through it. It's without being so tannic, it has all the dark notes that you want for, fish or shellfish in a simple, octopus also, in a simple application where It provides all the base notes that you need for the whole thing to work.
But it still has freshness.
It has the acid. It has the acid and it has a floral character too. So it's kind of, it'll frame out those kinds of dishes really well.
Let's see. And reds from the Loire Valley. We talked a little bit about, you know, the popularity of Sancerre. But there's potential and good value in some of the reds from that region.
There is. You just have to choose them well. And it's one of those things, again, there's not that many... There's not that many Americans that are going to choose a bottle of Chino and sit on their front porch and have it with a bowl of potato chips.
Right.
Not gonna happen. I would argue champagne is the thing to do that with.
I would agree with that.
I think I'm going to jump in and say that using champagne for more than just it's Uncle Bob's birthday is if I have a biggest cause, it's got to be that because of the food flexibility, because of the relative. If you want to drink something that is spectacular and is going to drink right now, you don't have to wait to age it, is maybe it's going to be more pricey than your average something in a wine store, but if it's from a very good grower that is not someone who you're paying for a ton of marketing with, most of the names that you know well you're paying for a ton of marketing with, a lot of those small grower champagnes that are good quality are remarkable things that are going to reward you right away for purchasing them. Anytime you want a good bottle of wine that's going to apply to just about everything except for a very fatty steak, and that's about the one thing it's not going to get done, or something with an awful lot of tomato in it because it's a very different kind of acidity. But sitting on my front porch, if I can have a glass of a good small grower champagne, just non-vintage, you're looking at something that's, you know, $40 or so, that you did not have to sit in the cellar for 7 or 8 or 9 years to become remarkably complex, and to come into balance.
Well, I think the key with that is get past the bubbles.
Yeah.
Get past the bubbles and assess the wine for what it is, and you find some remarkable flavors.
Well, the bubbles are functional, though. That's the thing, that the bubbles are functional with an awful lot of food.
Yeah.
But people are afraid. It's a little bit like the pink wine thing, or a little bit like the wine that sounds like it's going to be sweet.
Right. You know, but let's go back to Shinan. I love the wine, and we're not giving it its due.
So tell the world about Shinan. We're going to wrap up with Shinan. So
Shinan's
Again, you and I have gone through many Shinans. I remember showing you the Beaudry Shinan when I sold it years ago, and there was a particular vintage. And the thing about Shinan is it's Cabernet Franc. It needs to be ripe, and that's the problem with Shinan, is when it's not ripe, it's dreadful. But when it's ripe, it's magical.
Well, you're in good years for it. 2009, 2010, you have good ripeness. 12 is going to be also. So one of the, Lindsay referred to the benefits of global warming or the climate change.
I think I said climate change.
Yeah, you did. But anyway, please email us any questions on food and wine to foremanwolf@wypr.org. And thanks so much for being with me today, Patrick and Lindsay.